Welcome to another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast, brought to you by Courtroom Sciences. I am Dr. Bill Kanaski. Today, continuing our MedMal series. I don't have a MedMal issue at my house, but I have like a veterinarian issue. So this dog, here's the problem with my household, and I have nothing that I have zero responsibility whatsoever. I have a family here that has insisted on having a dog and cats. This is like a bad, I grew up watching Tom and Jerry, right? I mean, this should not get along. And it's making me nuts. Well, what's happened? So we take, and my vet bill, don't even get me started with that. So we go to the vet and the vet's like, okay, your dog's shoulder, like, cause she's been limping around. She has a bad shoulder and she's gained like 9 pounds. She's like clinically obese for a dog. And I'm sitting there like, wait a second. I just spent thousands of dollars on all this healthy dog food. What's going on? And what we found out is that this dog, the moment we leave the house, is sneaking upstairs and getting into the cat's food, which is very high caloric content. My guest, Dr. Jordan Romano, expert witness extraordinaire, hospitalist up in the Northeast. So happy to have you on, Dr. Romano. I don't know if any of your training went into, you know, veterinarian practice. Yeah, cross training. Do you
whatsoever.
Have any advice here? I have an obese dog because the dog's stealing the cat food. Any advice whatsoever?
Caloric restriction.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
So I have to buy one of these.
Or in this day and age, that maybe they'll come up with Ozempic for pets. I'm sure that's coming.
Yeah. So now I'm going to be spending thousands of dollars on that. Now they do have these things on Amazon. They have like these special cat feeders, like only the cat can get into. I have to figure this out, or my dog's going to weigh 150 pounds here. Dr. Jordan Romano, thank you so much for coming on. You are up in the Boston area, correct?
Certainly am.
How are the Boston Knights dealing with approaching the first? Okay, yeah, the NFL draft coming up, first football season in a million years without Bill Belichick. Are people just what's the psychological impact on society with no longer having Bill Belichick as the coach of the New England Patriots in that area?
Well, thankfully we've got some fantastic other sports teams. I was actually a Boston Bruins doc for a short period of time, which was just an absolute blast. The Celtics are fantastic, but I would say, yeah, we're in a transition phase. Yeah. I think everybody's kind of, there's just a melancholy, you know, just because it is not,
it's a change.
It is not the same. Absolutely.
It's a change. And, you know, I think everybody just really dislikes Kansas City now. Like everybody disliked the Patriots for a decade, and like we're so sick of these guys. And now it's like, no, let's maybe not like the Chiefs for a while. Well, thank you so much for coming on. You're a hospitalist, and you're also an expert witness. And I think that your story's very interesting. And so, you know, looking through your background, it appears that You kind of stumbled into the expert witness arena. Can you kind of tell us that story? Because I think everybody has a unique story on how they start to get into an activity like that. But it seems like you just kind of, it almost kind of fell in your lap, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I think it started by just generally being curious and chatting with folks. And this was a colleague who was, we were there somewhat late, I guess, and the workroom was not very full. And somebody looked a little off, and I just kind of asked them what they were up to, and they seemed a little busy, and they said, "Oh, I'm, you know, busy with the case." I said, "Well, can you tell me about the case? You like to exchange that, have a clinical exchange, and see if you could help somebody work through a difficult clinical story, perhaps, and help them figure out how to treat this hospitalized patient." And they said, "No, this is a legal case." And they said, "Wait. How long have you been out of residency?" I think at that point it was about 5 years. And they said, "Let's go out to lunch tomorrow. Are you free?" And I said, "Yeah." So we went to lunch, and I learned, over pizza, I learned all about MedMal. And this was a crash course because it was probably under an hour. I learned all about it. And then I was connected via email, and I was off to the races. I will say the ball started rolling downhill very slowly. I I would say, you know, that case wasn't followed up with another case for probably 6 or 8 months, but that's how it started.
Now, once you, you know, stuck your toe into the water, what was the most appealing thing about it? Because, and we were talking offline, you're like, you know, there's so many physicians in this country, but like, there's not a lot of expert witnesses. And I see, you know, anything legal tends to have a negative connotation, particularly to a healthcare provider, right? The last thing they in the world they want to do is thinking about legal things. So kind of what was the spark that got you interested to say, A, I think I'd be pretty good at this, but B, something that didn't drive you away? Because again, I think many people in the healthcare profession want to avoid any legal exposure, even as an expert, like the plague.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for punishment, but I've always been intrigued with, you know, why we just say we don't like something even though we haven't experienced it. Here's a food example. Maybe it's not the best analogy, but in New England we have a lot of oysters. You know, if you ask most people, do they like oysters, or they have this sort of visceral reaction, they'll make a face and say, oh, absolutely not. They're gross. They're slimy. They're this or that. But if you ask them how many they've tried, they probably would say, most people would say, oh, I haven't tried them.
Yeah. It looks
just
disgusting.
By the way. Exactly. What I would say is I didn't really know. I mean, it's going on a decade to get to where I am now. Yeah. So when I first started, I didn't know I would be good at it. And to be honest with you, I would say most people who start out in expert witnessing aren't necessarily, what is good? Like you don't even know the lingo. You don't even know what you're doing. So I was participating and sort of muddling along through it. And as I had more experience, I realized this is something I enjoy. This is something I could become good at. I think that's the important piece, is that I could learn this. And by learning it and be good at it, I mean learning the lingo, because the medicine we know, it's the understanding the arena that the medicine is being discussed.
Yeah. What was the learning curve for you going from a clinical practitioner, and as you're I remember when I went from, you know, being clinical neuropsychologist to getting into consulting and what I do now, I didn't even know what a deposition was. I didn't know the civil, like the learning curve was massive. And like, you know, I was watching, you know, A Few Good Men, the movie on, you know, you can't handle the truth. Like that was my legal, that was my legal exposure up to that point. And I didn't know any better. What was the learning curve for you going and getting into the legal aspect of this, and what kinds of things did you do to get up to speed on just learning the legal process?
You know, I would say there's a period where you don't know, and then there's a period where you know enough to be dangerous. As a physician, I think the it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where you have competence in, you would know about it.
Yep.
You have competence in one arena, and you think it translates to others. So there was a point where I became, and I see it with my mentees, they become almost overconfident despite not having true knowledge of you know what they're engaged in. And then you reach this other point where you're like, you know enough to know you've got a lot to learn. That not only is just there the lingo, there's every jurisdiction has nuance to the lingo and to the process. So generally speaking, yes, there's depositions, but pick a jurisdiction and there'll be different rules for how long they can depose you, what you charge and what they're allowed to accept, where, you know, the location, the timing of it. There's just so much nuance. And I think that's what fascinates me in the space.
Yeah. Cause it's, they had this analogy the other day I was watching online. I forget what the topic was, but the analogy was, like you could take the greatest athlete in one sport, you know, you take the Michael Jordan, right, in the early 90s, and he's the greatest athlete, maybe even in the world, depending on your perspective in basketball. And you put him on a football field, Well, he's still arguably, he's right. He's still
put
the greatest athlete in the world.
Put him on a baseball field. He played
or
baseball.
A baseball field, right? We saw that, right? And things didn't necessarily translate. Now,
that's right.
You know, now we got Bo. I got, because I'm sure Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders listened to my podcast. They're like, hello, hello. Because I mean, Bo Jackson totally pulled it off. Deion Sanders totally pulled it off, right? But Michael Jordan couldn't. So it's just, you're kind of, you got these skills, but you're going into, it's just a different world, right?
Well, yes and no. You're there to speak about the medicine, but the way with which you are speaking about the medicine is curated and crafted and controlled, because there are, because one side, depending on, you know, a plaintiff's will, side will see the events and want to paint one picture, and the defense will see the facts and have another picture or story they want to tell. And so you're operating in that arena, and so you have the facts and you're speaking about the facts, but people are taking your words and trying to, and I don't mean this in a disingenuous way, but they're trying to shape your words and
manipulate what they're
things.
Doing. That's exactly, yeah, don't, no, no, that's the reality of it, is whatever, whoever's cross-examining you is totally trying to manipulate you. We know this. Now, they will all deny it, and they're all full of shit, because I watch it every day on videotapes, and I listen, I see it in the transcripts, and they're trying to put words in your mouth. They're trying to twist your words. They're trying to, I mean, because obviously as an expert, you have a position that you're going to take. You have a stance on a certain issue based on your review of the record and whatever and data. And they're going to try to nudge you off of your position, right? And create some doubt, second guessing. And
or here's another way that it can happen. There's lots of different ways, but one way, and I dealt with this in a recent deposition, is they don't actually want to discuss your opinions because they don't have a logical explanation as to why things unfolded the way they unfolded. So they'll spend, this was a 3.5 hour deposition. They spend an hour and a half on my background and my job. And I took the first bathroom break, and I'm thinking to myself, we're an hour and a half in, like what's going on? And it hit me. Oh, they don't want to talk about the case. Now we got to the details, but we kind of blew through it. And sometimes it's not only about what's said on the record, but what's not said. And they don't, some things they don't want to be in the record.
Yeah. Can you describe, you know, I 22 years doing this, and I work on med mal cases every week. I work with a lot of specialists. Work with a lot of hospitalists like you and internists, but I work with a lot of specialists too. Can you describe your role? Because I think as a hospitalist, you are kind of like the Bill Belichick, and you're calling plays, and the team is doing, you know, you're the orchestrator here. Whereas the specialist kind of stays in their lane. You're kind of up here, right? At this higher level. Can you kind of describe? What's that like? Because I know that particularly with a lot of defense counsel that watch this, they're so accustomed to working with the cardiologist, the orthopedic surgeon, the cardiothoracic specialist. You know, the hospital, you kind of have to be a master of all trades, right?
Certainly, you have to know when to call somebody, when you need to know what you don't know, and know when you're uncomfortable, know when to call. I mean, this is the practice of medicine, you know, right? Yeah. Like, you have to know when to call someone. I would say, in terms of medical malpractice, what I've noticed is, and I think what you're alluding to perhaps, is that how one is engaged and the type of engagement is slightly different for someone like myself versus, say, a radiologist, right? Mm-hmm. A radiologist is read the films. And what's the read on the film? It's a very, the guardrails there are fairly tight. Whereas, for a hospitalist, it's sort of, what should he have done? Mm-hmm. When should he have done it? What are the alternatives? In radiology, it's what's the read of this chest X-ray, and what was your recommendation?
Yeah.
Or what was their recommendation, and do you agree with it? And that's kind of it. That's kind of it.
Yeah. So like, for example, with radiology, there's almost zero overlap. But, you know, somebody comes in and they're reporting the worst headache of their life. I mean, you know, enough, you don't have to call a neurologist immediately, right? There's some other things that you can do well before that. Whereas if you need imaging, you need imaging, right? There's certainly a big difference there. I would imagine some of the cross-examination that someone like you would get, like a hospitalist, which I've seen before, is the reminder that, well, doctor, you're not a neurologist, are you? You're not a cardiologist. Like they kind of use your generalist title against you and try to say, well, you're not this and you're not that, maybe trying to undercut your opinion.
Well, and I think sometimes that's true. The other way of looking at that is perhaps they're doing it to bound who you're going to be commenting on. You know, if I'm going to be commenting on the standard of care from the plaintiff side on the hospitalist, but there was a neurologist, a radiologist, and a cardiologist involved, they're doing that to bound your testimony, right? You're not there. I'm not dual boarded. You know, there's some people who are, I suppose, but typically you're there to comment on one specialty and one specialty alone. And so they're trying to bound your testimony, not in a negative way, but just sort of where's your lane and make sure you stay in it for your testimony.
Yeah. Describe your experience. This may be the most important question I ask you. And I want you to be brutally honest, because I don't think there's anything wrong with this, because I know it's different. I know that plaintiff attorneys and defense attorneys are wired very differently. You have worked on both sides, right? Describe your experience working with both sides, and maybe some of the kind of compare and contrast the difference between working with the plaintiff attorney and working with the defense attorney and the differences there, because it cannot be the same.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I would say, and just like anything else, there are different personalities in each of those. It's certainly not to color one or the other. I think there are individuals on both sides that I enjoy very much working with, and others that perhaps we may never work again because it just wasn't a good fit. Yeah. I would say, you know, typically your job, I would say your job is the same on both sides. You're trying to inform the retaining counsel what the breaches were and what the where you see the story, and you know, you're involved because something untoward happened. And so what you're trying to figure out is, in terms of standard of care, which is what would a reasonably prudent physician in same or similar circumstances have done. And so if you're on the plaintiff side, you're going to be helping outline or you're looking at the facts and outlining what should have been done that was not. And from the defense side, you're going to be looking at it and saying what was done was reasonable, and more likely than not, there was what this physician did or did not do did not cause something. I would say and this is advice that I would give, so this is how I'm going to answer your question, is with some advice, is that your goal as you go through your expert witnessing journey is to curate a list of individuals that you like to work with. And so people I'll mentor with will frequently call me if they're earlier in their journey and say something to the effect of, you know, they'll be frustrated dealing with this lawyer, and he's pushing me to do, you know, to do this and that. Yeah. And I don't really feel this, but you know, I'm trying to tell him these are my concerns with the case, and he doesn't seem to be listening to me. And I said, you know, all of this is good information, because now you can put this individual in a category of you won't work with them again. And that goes for either side, right? I think that you need to be true to yourself. And if you're not comfortable saying something and you don't feel like the facts show something, why would you? You're going to be called at some point, right? So the first part is you review the facts and you're having a discussion back and forth with lawyers. But then at some point you're going to testify under oath, right? Whether that's you're writing a report and that's going to be signed and submitted into record. You're going to be deposed and sworn in and give sworn statements there. And then ultimately you may go to trial. And so you need to be very comfortable with what you're saying, 100% of it. And the bar that I have is I say to myself at the beginning of a case, would I feel comfortable answering questions for 4 hours on this topic and on this situation? And if I hesitate, I tell the lawyer that too. I'm like, look, this is what we're up against here. No case is perfect. There's gremlins and everything. Sometimes the story doesn't fit and you're just trying to piece everything together. And you're also dealing with partial information in the beginning. So this is a long answer to a short question, but I guess what I would say is it is a process. During that process, you're going to be dealing with individuals who maybe have their own stresses, right? And yeah. So what I would say is curate a list of individuals that you enjoy working with. And I think that the early on, if you come across somebody that you don't enjoy working with, the reason it seems so easy to pigeonhole plaintiffs as pushy and aggressive, or defense as just overly sweep it under the rug and we can explain it away, is perhaps because your N is too small. You just haven't experienced enough of, it's a big country. You know, I mean, there's what, something like 20,000 malpractice cases every year. That's probably old data, but, and then there's rolling, right? They don't all just settle in 1 year. So there's active cases. There's a lot of active malpractice cases. You have not worked with enough people. And so what I would say is don't work for those people you don't enjoy working with.
Yeah.
And hopefully that was a long way of answering a very short question.
So you've been doing expert work for about 10 years?
Yes, that's right.
In 10 years of experience, I think this is an interesting question. What advice would you give attorneys to do things better? Because I'm sure the way you're engaged, the timeline in which you are engaged, I'm sure, like me, I'm sure you get some phone calls and you're like you're calling me now. I mean, like, what can attorneys do, regardless of whether they're plaintiff or defense attorneys? What can they do better when it comes to retaining experts, communicating with their experts? Like, what are some of the headaches that you go through where you could just announce to the world, stop doing this and do more of this?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. What I would say, it's tough. Communication's a two-way street. I see a lot of experts not making it easy on the attorneys. I always I shut my phone off for this, but it's always on. And so if somebody pings me, I'm always on top of it. I also have a virtual assistant now who helps me with some of my communications. And so what I would say is, speed matters in terms of for both sides. For instance, the analogy I frequently use is, if you're at a restaurant and your waiter or waitress comes to your table, you have their attention. But the second they move on, they're onto another table, they're onto another case. And so when a lawyer reaches out, you probably have there is a window there where they've kind of shut down that task item. Mm-hmm. So if you have the ability to respond or pick certain windows, the other thing I would say is leverage technology. I think what's exciting in the space is that lawyers and experts are leveraging technology to make all of this communication and file sharing just a smoother process.
Yeah.
I use Calendly. I know a lot of folks use that sort of calendar sharing availability. So I can just send you a link and you pick the time. There doesn't have to be the paralegal going back and forth and then, oh, talk to Jane, she'll set this up. Okay, Jane, what do you think? Oh, is this available? Not that. And then, six or eight, 10 emails later, you finally settle on a time and then it needs to be changed. Whereas with this app, I've plugged in my schedule and my availability. I send them a link and they pick their time and they can change their time if they want. I think that lawyers get it. We're all busy. And I think lawyers are picking up on leveraging technology to help them out. I think one of the challenges, however, is that the vast majority of medical malpractice is done by smaller firms. And so they probably do not have the resources or the manpower to, to handle things. I'm sure most experts would say, well, Jordan, why didn't you tell the lawyers pay on time, right? But I think you have to, I tend to look at things from their standpoint. I know new experts may get nervous, like, I'm not getting paid on time. Are they going to stiff me? I've been stiffed before. You know, knock on wood behind me there. You know, I curated a list of individuals where that just has never been an issue.
Yeah.
I think, and I have a tincture of patience, knowing that the cadence of their business is different. It's just not something we're used to in medicine. And they have a cadence of, you know, on the defense side, there's a lot of layers before that check can be cleared, right? They have to go up, the firm has to go to the insurance adjuster, and the insurance adjuster probably has a few levels, and then they give the okay, and then the firm can cut the check. On the plaintiff side, you know, they're spinning a lot of plates in the air, you know, and they have a cadence of cases settling and cash in and cash out. And so, you know, just a little bit of grace and making sure you're working with a firm that is reputable, you'll be fine. You'll get paid.
So it's chemistry, really, with.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Why? That's, I mean, work with somebody you enjoy working with. Why, you know, why it's kind of kind of silly. Why would you do anything else?
Well, you know, for rookie experts, and, you know, you kind of take what comes. You know, I was a younger consultant. I'd work with anybody just because I'm trying to build my career. And, you know, now it's like, if there's no chemistry, you can go find somebody else, and I'll find somebody else. And it's not worth the headache. Now this is probably the toughest question I'm going to ask you. This is brutal. Sure. I'm warning you right off the top.
Okay.
Describe what, if any, cognitive dissonance that you experience when testifying against somebody that has the same training as you, that's a provider just like you, has the same letters after their name. Describe the cognitive dissonance testifying against, quote unquote, a medical colleague. Because I see that has to be difficult, because I know from working on these med mal cases, the defendant physician always tells me the worst part of this is one or more people just like me from my area of training in medicine is shredding me and criticizing me and picking on me. And like, I can deal with the plaintiff attorney picking on me, but when it's somebody from like another physician throwing me under the bus, like, that's the most emotionally challenging part for a defendant physician. How do you deal with the emotions of doing that on the other side?
Listen, we have a duty to care for our patients. You know, when we took our oaths, it wasn't to one another. We have a standard in each one of our specialties, and this is maybe a little bit more somber and serious, but it is the truth. We have standards to uphold. And you know, interestingly enough, somebody pointed this out to me recently, which is if you belong to a society, go online, look at their buried in their mission statement and their bylaws, et cetera. Some very prominent societies buried in there will have a comment on expert witnessing. And most of them say something along the lines of, we actually wish more people would do it, because you have a responsibility to uphold the standards that you have been trained for. And I think that this is what this is about. This is why I'm comfortable being in this space, because it is about upholding standards. Yes, bad outcomes can happen. And yes, I do plaintiff and defense. It's somewhere between 60 to 70% of my work is plaintiff, but 30 to 40 of it is defense. And there are sometimes people just get it wrong, and it's a lawsuit. It looks something awful happened, but when you really look at it, there was honestly through no fault of that provider or those providers, it's usually more than just one that's involved in a lawsuit these days in any particular case. But when I'm doing this work, it is to uphold that standard. It is, okay. And I don't mean to be callous that I'm not thinking about the other person. I am looking at the facts of the case. Yeah. I am looking at what any reasonable doctor, not myself, not my standard, but what any reasonable internal medicine physician or hospitalist would have done or and should have done in that same or similar circumstance. And that's what this job, that's what this this role is for. Some people might find that a little bit callous, but I think that we have a duty to patients and we have a duty to the collective to uphold our standards. And this is the process by which it's done.
I told you it was a tough question. Now I'm gonna follow up with a related question. So it's essentially the same question, but kind of a subtopic here is, do you experience any emotional reticence, hesitation when testifying more locally versus where there's a case in California that they need you and there's, right? Because, I mean, listen, I mean, Boston's Boston, but, you know, Boston ain't, I mean, Boston's small, right? And I mean, for you to be an expert witness against another provider locally versus say, you get hired out here on a case in Central Florida where no one knows you, right? Do you approach those cases any differently there, or are you just able to stay focused? Because there's got to be some, I don't know, local, I mean, the local medical community, you know, how does that work? Because I can imagine there's like, is there any blowback locally for what you said? You see where I'm getting here? Yeah.
Thankfully, I've had some great advice early on to not sort of play in my own backyard.
Don't shit and eat in the same spot is what.
Yeah, right? There you go. So what I would say is, and some of it was, look, my insurance carrier, Massachusetts, you know, these hospital systems are quite large. So one of the first things you do when you look at a case is they ask you for conflicts of interest, right? Yeah. Do you know any of the parties involved?
Sure.
And some of it is, I see as a conflict is, if it's a plaintiff case and the other insurer would be somebody who insures me for my practice, I see that as a conflict. And so I've purposefully not taken cases in my geographic locale, certainly within the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I trained in New Hampshire. I have never taken a case in New Hampshire. I don't think I've ever taken a case in Vermont. I did have a license in Vermont during my residency training. I believe I've maybe taken one case in Maine. I'm not very active in Maine. Connecticut, Rhode Island also. I've done very minimal work, maybe one case over the decade. So I think that that's the best way to avoid conflicts is you do a conflict search and you just geographically, you're not geographically agnostic. You need to be geographically specific as to where you're operating.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A couple more topics here before we wrap up. Now I know this comes up. And I want to talk about trial in a second, but before I get there, at that position, I know that experts often, this happens at trial, but happens at depth too. Many experts get attacked based, quite frankly, on the economic reward of being an expert witness, and the questions are essentially implying that you're not okay. So the questions are pretty much coming across as, well, doctor, that like all this talk about upholding the standard of care and protecting medical practice, what you're really doing here is you're making a lot of money, aren't you? And in fact, that's the number one reason why you're doing this. Let's look at how many times you've testified this year. Oh, wow. Look at that. Let's add all that up. Boy, that's a lot of money, doctor. So you're telling me you're not doing this for, like, that's kind of like the standard cross-examination of an expert when it comes to the finance. How do you deal with that? Because it's fair game. It's fair game. And they're trying to portray you out to be, you know, really putting, you know, profit over things like patient care and stuff like that. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, you're being paid for your time. You're taking time away from your medical practice. And so it's remuneration for time away and time spent in service of the medical legal space and arena. The other thing to point out delicately is that if depending on who is lobbing that description of your remuneration,
Grenade. That's a grenade.
their expert is being paid
Yeah,
likely the same or
exactly.
similar amount.
Yeah.
So I think that it's usually those sorts of questions in it, and you've seen this, but to the listeners who aren't as experienced, a lot of times questions in depositions, obviously they're serious questions, but a lot of them are asked because they just want to see what your reaction's going to be. They want to throw you off
Yes.
kilter,
Yes,
and they
exactly.
want to focus. They want to focus on that versus what their client may or may not have done, right?
Yeah.
And so it is a it's an attempt to paint the expert at, in a certain light. It's not usually done in a complimentary way,
Yeah, no, it's not.
if handled appropriately, it is a short line of questioning, and then you move on to the pertinent facts of the case.
Absolutely. Now, curious question. Have you been sued as a defendant? Have you been a defendant before?
I have not.
Okay. Now I will tell you this. And I mean this, I know this, I can prove this. Defendant physician, this does happen several times a year, is that I will work with a defendant physician to prep, help train them for deposition or trial testimony. And their only testimony experience is as an expert like you. And this is their first
Correct.
time being a defendant. And what I find, it's like, because I have to break them down and rebuild them. And I'm trying to pull all those wires out of the wall, like, you're not an expert, you're not an expert, you're not an expert, you're not. And I tell you what, it's really difficult for that type of witness. So I hope you don't ever have to go through that. But if you
Same.
do, you need to call me, because I tell you what, the way your brain's wired, it's really hard to pull those wires out and reprogram yourself to be a defendant, right? Versus an expert, because it is a different objective. The questions are different, the answers, the jury sees you differently. Hopefully you don't ever have to go through that, but
Let's
it's
hope
a
so.
different it's a different environment. Have you testified at trial before?
Several times, yes.
And what so when you testify at trial, what do you think makes and again, be totally self-serving here. Please brag. I think that's a good thing. Brag. What makes you a good communicator in front of a jury, and what types of things are you trying to accomplish? And what I'm looking, because I think where I see, again, I see all kinds of stuff. I see experts, kind of some of the great things they do is they could be great teachers, particularly if they're allowed to get off the stand. Usually, maybe you're teaching some anatomy and physiology or whatever it is, and you become that teacher, and the jury sits there and goes, damn, like this person's, good, right? But then on the other side of it, I see it's probably the worst thing I see from experts is they take the bait on cross-examination and they get into an argument with the cross-examiner. And by the way, I don't care how good of an expert you are, I don't care how talented in medicine you are. If you try to win an argument with a professional arguer, you're going to lose 100% of the time. And I tell the defendants this. I'm like, don't get into an argument with the cross-examiner. You will lose 100% of the time. So when you go in front of a jury, what types of things are you trying to do to connect with that jury and to get your message across and not take bait?
You know, it's interesting. I've always felt like, you know, when if I'm giving a speech and I get on stage, or if when trial comes, it's actually a relief. I actually feel quite relaxed at that moment, just because there's been a lot of preparation. I've spent a lot of hours, and that's the thing to keep in mind. When the people are listening that are experts, that don't have that much trial testimony, you know, you're pretty much locked in into you. There aren't going to be that many surprise questions. You kind of know what's
You
coming.
know what's
So
coming, yep.
you need to, it's really just about self-control at that point, and just being yourself. and certainly engaging and communicating, as you said, with the jury, and then being ready for that cross and that somebody may attack you, and just remember what you said, and remember that all of these things are open book interrogations. If they say, you know, well, you know, Dr. Romano, in your deposition, you said, didn't you say X, Y, and Z? Well, let me look at my deposition. I need to look at that. Well, you're taking what I said out of context. Actually, if you look at the line before it and after it, this is what we were discussing. And so I think it's, you have to be careful too, because again, you're an advocate for the truth and you're an advocate for the facts. You can't be an advocate. You are not, and this is where I see experts get in trouble, is where they're an advocate for the case or for one side or the other. And when you project yourself in that manner, certainly at trial, keep in mind, and I shared this in another forum, that in one of my first trials, when I was done, within 6 months, the defense side had given me several cases, and this was a small jurisdiction, but they gave me a lot of cases, and some of it, I'm certain, was they didn't know me before this trial, but they saw me at the trial. And it was an interview, if you will. And so had I fought, you know, with the professional arguers, or fought with the attorney who was cross-examining me, I mean, that's just, it's not appropriate. And it hobbles your experience and future as an expert, but it's also, you know, at the same side, and it's an art that you and I, I'm sure, both teach, which is you also can't be a pushover, right? And
exactly.
tell somebody what they want to hear.
Yeah.
So I think there's a fine line, but again, for testifying, it's a skill. It takes reps to do it, but there are definitely things you can do. And for me, I've always felt almost like a relief when it happens, not even afterwards, just in the experience. I just enjoy it.
That's outstanding. Well, let's conclude here. Tell us about, because I know you have a coaching practice. And I find this fascinating because I've not heard of this before, because I know that you encourage physicians to do expert work. You think this is a positive thing. And it sounds like you received some mentorship and some guidance from some other people when you kind of started off. Tell me what you're doing in that regard for maybe a physician out there that wants to be an expert but kind of doesn't know where to start, and maybe was in the same shoes that you were back in the day 10 years ago. What types of things that you can provide to them through your coaching practice?
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to chat about that. Most of what I was doing in recent years was kind of behind the scenes. I've made things a little bit more visible at medicalexpertwitness.com. If anybody just wants to chat with me, I make myself available. You can see my Calendly and you can set up 30 minutes to chat. And this is for if you're brand new starting out, or you have an experienced practice, but you're just need some help tweaking X, Y, or Z. I'd love to chat with you. I chat with hundreds of experts every year. Most of what I offer is a bespoke mentorship, where we work through your issues, and it's the relationships are anywhere from, say, 3 months to 18 months, depending on what you need help with and what sort of relationship we devise. I do have some offerings that are going to be more digestible by a wider swaths of individuals that are coming out. When I first started, I would say there wasn't a lot. I don't think there was much at all in the way of by physicians for physicians. And I think that, you know, as I said earlier, I would love to see, you know, come back and chat with you 5 years from now, and there's five times as many physicians in this space, because I think we just need to raise the bar of not only and uphold the standards, not only of our practices, but of the expert witnesses themselves. The sort of, veneer that people see on this space is not one that's shiny. And it's a shame, because the people that I see working in this space are phenomenal. There are a lot of tremendous physicians in this space. And for those who, I really see folks as looking at the icky oyster, but really, to me, it is something that I enjoy. I will say too, a lot of people look at me, they'll probably read the show notes from this and look at my pedigree and say, well, isn't it easy for you, Jordan? You know, you trained at Dartmouth, you've been at Harvard for over a decade. That's why you're successful. And I will tell you, the vast majority, almost every one of the individuals and physicians, and I would say nurse practitioners, PAs, yeah, and nurses, which we didn't talk about, which is a huge space that's in need as well for, yeah, experts.
No, you're right.
And growing. You know, the vast majority of the people that I mentor and that have benefited from working with me do not have an Ivy League background. You do not need an Ivy League background. Has it helped me? Yes. But do I get passed over? And have I been passed over many times? And people even told me that we think a younger Ivy League physician, I was told this by a defense firm, on the eve of trial, they said the jury isn't going to respond well to you. And they didn't tell me this. I didn't even know how this worked. They had another pocket expert. They had somebody in the wings who happened to be an older gray-haired female. And I didn't even know that that's how the game was played in certain jurisdictions. And so, you know, I love helping people. I wish I had somebody to help explain this. I stumbled. I made so many mistakes. Yeah. I went into depositions thinking I knew what was going on and just had yeah, they wiped the floor with me on both sides. And yeah, so I think that you can make a meaningful impact in your career, in your space, by participating in medical malpractice. There are lots of folks out there. I'm one of them who can help you. And check me out at medicalexpertwitness.com. I'd love to hear your story.
And for any of the attorneys, we have a bunch of attorneys that listen to this podcast. How would they contact you if they wanted to run a case by you and maybe even retain you as an expert, as a hospitalist or internist?
Same thing, medicalexpertwitness.com. There's a link on there that I've put on there. Great. Recently, because lawyers reach out sometimes, whether to talk to me about experts or tap into my network. Yeah. I love learning. And that's the other thing that makes a great expert, is that you want to learn from these lawyers. I think you're being tongue in cheek with it as well to paint lawyers in a certain way. But some of these relationships, you can tell sometimes they're busy, but when somebody is like, they really have been, they've been practicing MedMal in South Florida for 25 years. That's a mentor, right? Like, speak to that lawyer and just say, help me understand how this is going to unfold. They'll drop so much knowledge on you in 2 minutes. Sure. You will be just, and they'll enjoy it. So I think it flows both ways. For me, this is to get experts up to speed in the space, but you'll learn a lot from lawyers, and certainly lawyers, if you're listening, I'd love to chat with you and talk to you about medical malpractice.
That's awesome. Dr. Jordan Romano, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I thought this was a terrific conversation. Let's hope the Patriots trade up and take my guy, Drake May, out of the University of North Carolina, the next superstar, the next Tom Brady. But yeah, you never know, right?
Go Pats.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you to our audience members. We love you. We like doing this podcast. We like having great guests like Dr. Morano. This is a really, really great podcast. Thank you so much for participating in this edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast. We will see you next time.